Welcome back to the Making Money Podcast, where we talk about how to make more money, keep more of what you make, and make your money work harder for you. I am your co-host, Benjamin Foss, and sitting across from me, as always, is the wonderful entrepreneur and business owner, Paul Ng. Paul, how are you today, my friend?
I am very well, thank you, Ben.
We are excited to be continuing kind of the theme of same kind of idea of last week of just sharing some of the lessons that we've learned as business owners and entrepreneurs over the years. You, many more years than me in this space and much more wisdom and experience. But, you know, me also like having put a lot of thought into certain things and taking things from different people, different books and materials and trying them and applying them and saying like what works, what doesn't work, what actually yields fruitful results versus what doesn't seem to work so well for me. And so I'm excited to dive into this. But before we do, I would love to hear from all of you. Both Paul and I would love to hear from all of you about what are some of your most impactful lessons that you've learned as business owners or entrepreneurs or even just in life. We would love to hear from you guys, and feel free to drop a comment below, especially if you're on YouTube. It's super easy to do that there. So my first one, and also I want to like put a disclaimer for all of you. I have not shared any of my notes with Paul tonight. I had told him that I was just going to surprise him with my bullet points because I want to get a live, real reaction. Not that anything in here is particularly crazy, but I like to have that dynamic. And also, I don't know what Paul's going to say. So we're going to have like a real live conversation and dialogue, real authentically, which I think is super cool.
Love it.
So my first lesson is do the hard shit first. So if you are starting your day and you're, you know, getting to work, getting productive, it's very easy to start with the easy things because it's like, oh, I want to get a few like quick wins under my belt and do like the and start feeling productive. But what happens a lot of times is we end up accidentally in chasing the endorphin rush of just the feeling of productivity rather than chasing what is actually the most productive thing that we can do for that given day. So instead, what I like to do is identify like what is the one thing that if I accomplish this today would move the needle for my business the most, and then do that first. And it's not something that I always do because, you know, I get ADD and, you know, this thing and that thing over there, but it's something that I really strive for. And what I find is when you get the hard stuff out of the way, then the easy stuff is easy, right? And it's easy, but also I find you end up working on the most important aspects of the business more often because you don't get your time just completely occupied by busy tasks or just routine day-to-day stuff rather than building and growing the business. So my implementation or my advice for this particular point is identify one task per day that yields the biggest return for your business. What is the lever that you can pull that is the most profitable, and then make that the first thing that you do when you start your working day? Paul, what do you think?
I love that. I'm kind of the opposite, though. In the world of taxes, in particular, it's about getting the returns done in a quick and timely fashion. So the complicated returns are more daunting, which would take a lot more thought and effort into, whereas I'm trying to bang out the quicker and simpler ones, only because it's by volume for a person that's in tax preparation. And a lot of times I put those aside thinking I'll work on the harder one first. And a great example is this morning I woke up, it was about 5:45, got myself together and sat behind the desk and was working. And I realized, you know, I have 6 really simple returns that I could bang out that I could make X dollar from real fast instead of doing this really complicated one, which takes me almost 2 hours to 3 hours to bang out for the same amount of money that I would have done banging out 6 of these little ones. So I looked at it and I thought, well, I'm going to do these rather quickly so that they're out of the way and my pile shrunk down a little bit. So it gave me a little sense of accomplishment. But to validate your point, which I really do like, of working on a more difficult task and something a little more challenging, let's call it, it gives you a sense of success. I think that's a really good word I want to use, a very strong word, success, meaning that the accomplishment had a goal and the goal was met. That's what success really means. A lot of times we think of success by measuring it as a monetary good. I try to take that equation out of success. I look at it as I've accomplished and I've succeeded. That means I get to move on, so the milestone is met. Oftentimes we get so wrapped up that we forget what it is to actually accomplish something because our mindset is in the wrong place.
I think that what you were talking about is very valid. And I do that sometimes too. Like I have a group of appraisals that I want to do and like, well, let me just get the easy ones done first because, you know, clients are tracking by turn time. And like this one over here is going to take 2.5 hours to write. These others are going to take 45 minutes or whatever, you know? And so I get that, but that's actually not even really necessarily what I'm talking about. It's more like, if you are building a business, like you're at a point with your tax business where you're not really focused on lead generation because you have more business than you really want some days, I think.
Some days.
Yeah. So, but if you're building a business and you're like, okay, I can work on this like routine, you know, work of just the wheels turning, or I have this target of growing the business by X percent this year, and here's my checklist of things that I need to do to reach that target. But those things are new. They often involve learning outside the comfort zone, you know, those kinds of things. And that adds to the difficulty and it adds to that sometimes feeling of, do I really want to do that right now? Like, oh, let me do this other stuff over here is easy, familiar, and real quick. And I'll just, you know what I mean? So it's more about categories of differences rather than like sorting the same kinds of tasks by difficulty, if that makes sense. It's just more like make sure that you are prioritizing the things that are actually going to grow the business if that is your goal. If it's not your goal, then, you know, more power to you, like do the routine. But it's just to make sure that the routine doesn't override the growth goals and then you just never end up doing the work because it always gets put last and then falls off the cliff.
That's a good point, Ben.
So, Paul, what is your first lesson for us today?
My first lesson is get out of your comfort zone.
Oh, yeah.
I feel this is a huge, large part of our lives, not even huge, very large part of our lives that we put blinders up on. We kind of get into this fly-by-night, coasting by, blinders up, and we forget that there's whole other part of the world that we're not taking a part of, learning, teaching, skill sets that are new to us that we are afraid of. Let's get out of that comfort zone of, okay, this is my skill set and I don't want to get out of there. Sometimes it's great, but sometimes it's not so great because we're missing out in a great opportunity. As technology grows, we should grow with it, and that's my area of not comfortable. And anyone who knows me knows that I get very apprehensive about technology and using it.
I've been pushing you a little bit.
You have,
with Facebook,
absolutely.
And social media.
Yeah, Facebook scares me. I know how to search Reels. Not even search. I just know how to watch Reels and hit like all night long.
That's like a slot machine, man. They make that as easy as possible because they want you hooked.
They sure do. But I'm learning that social media has a great presence in today's world. It really gives us an opportunity to market. It gives you an opportunity to get into a flow. It gives you an opportunity to see what those parameters are out there. And it gives you the opportunity to see what the numbers look like, you know, the data from it. And I get very scared. So my comfort zone really is coasting along in what I know best. But there are times, and they are now, where I need to learn more. And some advice I would give our listeners right now is don't be afraid. Don't get complacent. Learn and adapt, because the world is going to keep changing. And if we don't change with it, me particularly is I guess, is a fear factor. And now I've become the fuddy-duddy that I said I would never become. And I don't even know a better word to say, but I've become that person. And learning through this, learning through others, how to get out of my shell and open up to the idea of, oh, using software that I'm not familiar with or using an app that I'm afraid of has really opened up my eyes.
There was something that gave me a real sense of urgency around getting out of my comfort zone related to AI and really diving in and learning it, which is something I've been doing over the last month. I saw a video where there is an individual who got to attend a sort of like secret, or not really secret, but just behind closed doors meeting among like top Silicon Valley executives. And one of the top executives there, and they didn't name names because they're not supposed to really share anything from this meeting. But one of the executives was asked, where are we, like, if AI was the internet, what year are we in? And he said 1997. I was like, okay, so that means still early stages, and there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of change that's right around the corner and happening already, as we are seeing. And the more that I've explored the technology and the tools, the more that particular video, that year, 1997, that idea has been just repeating in my mind and going, I think he's exactly right. Because I mean, even just thinking about the shift, Gen Z and a lot of the like younger, you know, I mean, I'm still young, but you know, like people even much younger than me don't even use Google anymore. It's all ChatGPT or whatever AI, you know, Grok, if you like to use X, or, you know, there's so many AI tools out there. But there's so like, and OpenAI now has their own proprietary search engine built into ChatGPT. So it mimics many of the functions of Google. It's still not as good as Google, but Google's been doing this a lot longer than OpenAI has, the search function anyway. And I thought, it's only a matter of time before SEO, search engine optimization, is really like AIEO, artificial intelligence engine optimization, or whatever, you know, because or AI SEO maybe, because people are now like, wherever people are searching and looking for information, that's where you want your business to be. You know, if they're searching for something relative to your business, that's why right now I'm running Google AdWord campaigns for my appraisal business. So if you're in the Denver area and you're searching for appraisers, like, I want to come up first or second. I want to be right there at the top, because like, that's where people with intent to utilize my services are going. But if that's shifting to AI now, now you got to start thinking about that, you know. And then does OpenAI start to incorporate advertising, you know, like buying ad space, kind of like Google does for their like AI searches. So it's opened up a whole can of worms. But the long story, a long path for a short drink of water, as they would say, that I'm getting to is, if you do not push yourself out of the comfort zone and learn either new technologies or new methods or techniques or whatever it is that you know you should do, but you're kind of scared to do, you're missing out on not only so much learning opportunity, but you don't even like, it's like you don't know what you don't know. And it's not until you actually get into the process of using a technology, especially, and learning it, that you see where the opportunities are and where your business could have a unique advantage.
Absolutely. I think following the footsteps of the new generation, I think, is huge. This whole AI thing, Ben, I tell you, it scares the ever-living heebie-jeebies out of me. You know, I have conversations quite frequently with many of my clients and friends, and this whole artificial intelligence, robotics, replacing people, it's become real. You know that song in the year 2525? Well, we're in the year 2525, so what does that mean? You know, all those predictions in that song have already come and gone. We're actually in a whole new realm of 2525. And that is crucial because the whole next movement really isn't about here we have a new computer. It's really about how they've integrated a computer into actual life, right? Versus, okay, typing and getting an answer. Now we don't even type to get the answer. Now you just ask and boom, it actually writes you a whole research paper. It writes your resume for you. It's a lot more than just here I'm typing something. You don't even type it. The computer's done it all for you.
Well, even my notes for tonight's podcast were organized by ChatGPT. I kind of just typed a big paragraph of just a bunch of thoughts. I said, okay, organize this for me. And it's like, man, this is nice. This is great. I don't have to worry about the formatting. I can just put in my thoughts and what I want to say, and then it can sort it and organize it into a very easy to read, super legible outline, and I don't have to waste time formatting. You know, so I love the efficiency element of that. And speaking of efficiency, that actually is my second lesson or lesson point.
Efficiency. Well, let's talk.
My second lesson is that efficiency compounds. Now, what does that mean? Small optimizations stacked together lead to really big returns. So, for example, like in my workflow, in my appraisal workflow, I have 100 little things that I do to shave a couple seconds here, a few seconds there off of the workflow. Just repeated tasks, things that I do not only multiple times per day, but multiple times per job even. And if you stack that, you know, if you automate a 10-second task, it saves 8 minutes per week if you do that task 50 times. You stack that up over a month, it's 8 times 4, it's 32. You know, it's an extra half an hour per month. Now stack 4 of those efficiencies. Now you have an extra 2 hours a month. And but it starts with a 10-second efficiency. But these little things grow. And it's a similar example to, I saw there's a YouTube channel, and I am blanking on the name of it at the moment, but they kind of specialize in breaking. They actually tear vehicles apart and give advice to manufacturers on how to make their process of manufacturing more efficient. Mm-hmm. And they tore down a Tesla, and they pulled out this little plastic piece from the underside that was just like a pin, basically, that was unnecessary. And they noticed that it had been removed from like one model year to the next. And they're like, this thing probably costs about 3 cents. And you may think this is like totally insignificant, doesn't matter. But then they did the math. They're like, okay, but they removed 3 of these per vehicle. So that's 9 cents per vehicle. And they do this many of these per year. And then over 5 years, a 5 year like lifespan of a model, let's say, it ended up being like $300,000. Ooh. Or the savings, or I don't remember the exact number because it's been a couple years since I watched the video, but I just remember that blew my mind about how such a tiny little change, when you stack it over enough volume, makes such a dramatic impact. And when I think about processes in a workflow, either as an employee or as a business owner or as someone who is an entrepreneur trying to build processes for my business, for the employees that I'm training, those little optimizations, they can be overlooked so easily because they feel small and insignificant until you take the time to think about what the scaling looks like. And as your business scales, so does your inefficiency many times. And so being on top of those inefficiencies early on, I think, can really make a big difference.
I totally agree. You know, monetizing and capitalizing on your time is where this efficiency is going to. And understanding that, you know, 2 minutes here and there, they really do add up, you know. And if I had an extra 2 hours in a month, that would be called sleep.
No, or reels.
But honestly, you know, time is equating to dollars and cents when you own a business. It really does.
Well, Paul, what is your second lesson for us?
My second lesson is going to be on cultivating relationships and planting those seeds.
Okay.
And oftentimes we don't feel that a customer is worth that time. Oftentimes we feel that, well, shoot, they're indecisive. I can move on. I don't need them. Whatever comes to mind, right? In other industries such as mine, they're very worthwhile because I have clients that have gone to seminars that I've hosted or seminars that I've presented in. And years later, I get a phone call, and this happens all the time. Yesterday is a prime example. Yesterday, I got 6 new contacts from who knows how long ago. And I don't even remember these people. They were just saying that, you know, so-and-so said you were a great person and they went to your seminar and recommended you. And then the other one was, I was at your seminar, which is actually last summer. We were there. We were guests of friends of ours. Well, we're finally ready to make the jump. And it was great. I mean, I had 6 and they weren't all from seminars, but most of them are referrals. But what's great is that, you know, it's nice to know that people over time have referred and over time those referrals have reached out. And oftentimes we kind of blow them away if we met them once and they never call back and you have their card or you don't remember who they are. In my instance, I really don't remember who they are, but I'm grateful because after just making a couple of calls today that Candy did for me to set up those appointments, it was another eye-opener. Whereas I look at, wow, in one day, I grew my business literally by 6 people. And if I take that, and most people think, well, that's literally not even 1% of your business, Paul. So why would that matter? And I always say, every year, so many people leave and go to an H&R Block, or they go to somebody else for whatever reason.
And we call that churn.
Yeah, and for me to recapture that churn, 6 people in one day, it's pretty amazing. This morning, I had a client, and the client that came to see me was the daughter of the client that passed away. So 2 weeks ago, I get a phone call, and Candy picks it up for me as I'm in a meeting, and she takes the phone call and sets an appointment up for my client, whose daughter said, the father passed away. I've come to do his final return. Well, I meet her this morning, her and her husband, and finish the return. Well, once I finished the return, she said, well, my husband and I would like to see you in a couple of weeks, and I think I'm going to bring my kids with me too. So it's amazing how that referral that came to me years ago, passed away, never have met the daughter or the husband, had a short 20-minute meeting with them doing the final deceased return, and all of a sudden it was impressive enough that they want to come see me instead of their regular person, and now they want to bring their kids. Mind you, this person, she's in her probably 70s is my guess, late wow. 60s or 70s. And the father that passed away was 94. So I only to assume that she's got to be at that age. And then her kids must be in their 40s or 50s is my guess, if not late 30s. And so it's very important to know that those seeds that you plant and cultivating those seeds and getting those seeds to germinate, meaning that they have now sprouted and they're going to grow, they're growing with you. And you never know what impact you're going to have when you're doing a service or provided a product to somebody, where that's going to lead. I actually had no idea this was going to lead to a daughter finishing a deceased return, or better yet, you know, meet them, do the return, and then they want to come see me, and then another generation wants to come see me. So cultivating a client, nurturing, whatever the word you want to call it. I mean, those are fancy words.
It's all about relationship.
It is about relationship. Yeah. And it's building that relationship. I always believe that the experience you leave with somebody is going to be the most memorable. Most people automatically look at myself as, oh, well, he's Asian, so clearly he's good with numbers. I mean, that's the very first stereotypical.
That is the stereotype, yeah.
Absolutely, and I don't mind that whatsoever. Or oftentimes I will get this one as well. Oh, I didn't think you were Asian by the tone of your voice on the phone. I get that at least once a week, at least. And it's kind of comical because I don't think of ethnicity having to do with anything. If you have an ability, you have an ability, right? It's not dictated just because I'm Asian. So a lot of times, all the time, not even a lot of all the time, I think in the back of my head, do they just believe this because somebody told them, or is there some validation to this? Because in my head, I don't think of all Asians are good at math. I really don't, or numbers.
Right. Yeah.
I just think of a person as a person.
There's stereotypes and stuff out there, and you know, some are maybe more true than others, but you know, I remember there was one time I was hiking in northern New York in the Adirondack Mountains, and there were some guys who were like software engineers who you know just happened to be like hiking along like in this at the same time. And they were from India and had like the thick accent. And it just, it was just one of those examples of just like people who fit the stereotype like very well. And I mean, they were great. They were awesome. But I was kind of chuckling a little on the inside because it's like, I'm in New York for like one day and like already met Indian software engineers, you know?
Oh, that's comical.
But comical. Yeah, we all, you know, we have some of those exist, you know, for a reason, some of them not, but you know, but there's also always people who break the mold, right? There's people Absolutely. Who break the mold. And so, you know, like when I go to restaurants and I ask for spicy food, I have to clarify, like, I don't mean white people spicy. Like I'm no, I look like a tub of Elmer's glue, but like I can handle some heat, like, lay it on me.
You might handle more heat than me, Ben.
I was cracking up. I actually saw a video on Instagram where this guy was going to some restaurant in California. It's a Mexican place. And this lady was like being like super like charismatic and outgoing and who's like taking the orders. And the dude who was ordering was a white guy. And he was like, she's like, how spicy do you want it? Like white people spicy, whatever, you know, like kind of mm-hmm. like playing it. And, but everyone was laughing and having a great time. And it was great.
I love it. I love it. I'm going to go into my third lesson, actually, because it kind of flows with this.
Go ahead.
And it's don't ever judge a book by its cover. All honesty, it's hard to not judge because we're human. It's a given. But I'll tell you, in all honesty, you never know what's happening with a person. Or even better yet, they may be so humble about themselves, you do not even know the skill sets that they actually possess. A lot of times we go into, I'm just going to use this as an example, we go into a meeting and we have an expectation of what this person on the other side should look like, should have these skills of, and should be able to. And why is that such a disappointment when we actually meet them and they're not to our aesthetically appealing like, or their voice or their tone isn't to what we expect, or we feel that they're too snooty or they're not smart enough? I don't know about you, Ben, but to me, I like to have very open-mindedness when I meet people. I always give a lot of praise for their abilities to be where they're at today. You know, I get a lot of praises from people when they look at me and they say, oh my gosh, you've sure done a lot. How old are you again? And it's a compliment, but also is a little, has a little negative tone. I'm going to use that word instead. Because I feel that it should not be judged just because of A, if I look younger than I am, or B, I have more experiences than others. It's being able to present and offer the skills that I have to you. It's the same as if I look at you. I'm not going to judge you by what you look like or how you're dressed or how you're talking. You're offering your skills to me, the skills I do not have. One of which is I am not anywhere mechanically inclined to use a tool, not even a yeah. hammer or a screwdriver. This is plain truth. I will hire somebody. I will ask somebody before that. And that's because they have the skill set I don't. It's like looking at a car. I don't know what a car, a Rolls Royce even looks like. This is pathetic. I really don't. I barely know what a Porsche looks like, you know? So never judge a book by its cover. There's so much more to learn from that other person, so much more to gain and to give. It's a reciprocal relationship there. I mean, it's a give and take relationship. I'm giving you a service. You're learning how to, you know, what it is that I'm doing, and you're paying me for that service. So I'm getting something out of it. I'm giving you something. So end of the day, give and take, learn, and don't judge a book by its cover, because you do not know what's behind that brain.
You do a great job of that, I think, of like being very open and accepting to people. And, you know, there's times where people are saying things, you know, that I like internally, I'm like, that sounds kind of foolish or whatever, but you like hold your tongue, you listen, you ask questions. And then more often than not, I've noticed you don't really speak up unless you're invited to share your thoughts or your perspective on things. Like, you're very slow to offer that. And I think it's because you have such a, that like mindset of humility and listening and curiosity of wanting to hear what other people have to say. And I think that that level of openness and humility is a beautiful thing. And you're right. You oftentimes people close themselves off from learning opportunities. And I know I've done it. You know, I'm guilty of it for sure in the past, of closing myself off from opportunities to learn from people because I assumed that I had this box that I could put them in based off first impressions, and then didn't even give them the opportunity to surprise me with something else down the road. And, you know, most people, there's more to them than meets the eye at first. And you never know what you're going to miss out if you don't go beyond that surface level.
Absolutely. And one lesson to teach all of us from everything I've spoken about tonight is learn how to respond and not just react.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
So, Ben, let's talk about your number three.
My number three is much more down to earth, or, you know,
I love it.
Dry is another word we could use. Know the value of your time. And this can start very simply as just divide annual income by annual work hours. If you work 40 hours a week, that's 2,000 hours a year. So if you make $200,000 a year, your time is worth roughly $100 an hour. And I like doing the math on that and really considering that, because it helps you create a framework and a threshold for what you should be outsourcing versus what you should be doing yourself. If your time is worth $100 an hour, you should not be changing your own oil in your car. Like, even if you can, because it takes them half an hour, it costs $80. Like, just pay someone to do it, right? Same thing with like cleaning a house. You know, I recently hired house cleaners because I was like, yeah, I could spend 3 hours, 4 hours a week, whatever, like doing a proper clean of this house, or I could pay someone else $150 and then I can take those 3 and 4 hours back and work on the business or work on whatever things that I'm trying to build right now. And that is the point of this exercise of knowing the value of your time. And the point of the outsourcing is not just like, oh, this is beneath me. It's like, no, I can sweep floors and stuff. Like, it's not beneath me. It's about reclaiming time to work on building toward goals, work on these dreams that I'm chasing, this business that I'm building. And if I'm spending time doing menial tasks that I can outsource for relatively cheap compared to the time cost for me, like, I think that's a worthwhile thing to do. It's also part of the reason why, like, I don't cook very often for me personally, because it's not something that I particularly enjoy. But also, if it takes me an hour to cook and my time is worth $100 an hour, that's $100 worth of labor that I'm giving up, plus the cost of the actual food. That's a pretty expensive meal. You know, now there is a balance to this, because if you are lower income or just don't have much cash, then, you know, sometimes like you have more time than money. And if you have more time than money, then spend the time, right? But you get to a point where you have more money than time, And then you use that money to buy back time to help make more money or whatever. Maybe it's to spend more time with your family. Like maybe you're in a place where like, yeah, I make a great income and I like my wife and I could spend a few hours every weekend, like cleaning the house, or we could spend those hours with our kids, you know? So I don't think most people like actually know and calculate the value of their time and like work through that exercise. So I think it's a really like powerful and valuable exercise to walk through.
I agree with you 100%. So in my salon where I have stylists there, they always go, well, what would you charge for this? I always say it's $1 to $2 a minute depending on your service. So what do you want to charge them? And then they start doing the math and they're saying, well, $2 is too much. I don't feel that's right because they're only going to be in my chair for 45 minutes. And I say to them, what do you think your time is worth?
Yeah.
And that's what you're implying is what is your time worth? To me, I look at it as every minute that I have to spend in a salon behind the chair doing my client's hair is time I should be paid. Whether or not I want to be competitive or not is not the question. The question is, what is my worth? As you just said, what is my worth? And I feel like my worth is behind the chair at a salon is roughly about $120 an hour. So if they're going to be there for 2 hours, they need to plan on spending $200+ sitting behind my chair because I won't take the time that they're processing as time to be charged. But the time that I'm actually standing on my feet, working on somebody's hair behind the chair, you know dang well I'm going to charge you $2 a minute to stand because that's precious time.
That's a great point. I hadn't really thought about this as applied to pricing for especially like service-based businesses. But it reminds me a little bit of my older brother, James, who's working tile. You know, he has a certain dollar amount that he wants to make per 8-hour working day, although he ends up working more than 8 hours many days. But it's kind of a similar thing of, when you're pricing out jobs, services, whatever it is that you're doing, it's not even just for the outsourcing application that I said, but also, when you're setting prices and fees for things, that's a great way to look at it. And listen, if you get to a point where you're charging so much that you're hearing no so often that you're not making any money, then you can always adjust them back down, you know. But I think more often than not, most young like entrepreneurs and business owners are not charging enough because they're so afraid of hearing no and getting rejected and not making the sale or whatever that they end up selling themselves short and not making hardly any profit.
I agree 100% right there. I always counsel my clients who are entrepreneurs that are starting in a new venture, we'll call it. I ask them, what is your goal? And they always have these large-scale goals, as we're going to call them. They're not even like, you know, reachable or attainable by any means. Because, you know, you look at it and they think, well, I have a dream board and my dream board says this. Well, you have to scale up to there. Very few entrepreneurs have struck it gold on their first try in their first year. You're usually in the black after 3 years. I mean, you're in the red for 3 years first. But a good goal really is somewhere around $500 a day. I think that's a very realistic goal because 7 days a week at $500 a day is $3,500 a week, and $3,500 a week, and you take that times 50 weeks, not even 52 weeks, you're at $150,000. So, you know, it's not far out to be talking about $150,000 a year, right? Average. And then,
Depending on where you live, that's like barely middle class.
Very true.
Like here, you're kind of, that's middle class.
That is.
Like, I think the median income in like Douglas County is somewhere around there.
I think it's 150 or 175. But that's really, you know, I hate to say it, but that's just getting enough to get you by and a little bit of savings. Now, you flip it around and you're in California, in San Francisco or LA, you're going to need to make somewhere around $500,000 to even equate to what that looks like here.
And probably,
that's called, you know, barely middle class. you know.
Yeah, like 100 grand is the poverty line.
It is poverty. If you look at Section 8, it starts at 110,000.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. You can make 110.
People think Denver is expensive.
I know.
It is relative to Alabama, but if you go to either coast to where it's not nearly as bad.
It's not. But, you know, honestly, your time is worth money. And as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, know your value, like you said. Know your value, know your worth, and know how much you need to be in your goal. Let's just use the word goal, you know, your milestones, whatever that word is, but goal. You know, it takes proper planning to get the proper results to get those goals met.
It really does. And I wanted to kind of drop one more like anecdote here, because I did, you know, for years, well, I used to be against the whole outsourcing house cleaning thing. I was like, well, you're too high and mighty to clean your own house. Like, I just didn't understand it until like the buying back time thing. I was like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense for me. But I used to have very similar thoughts about the idea of flying private, which I've never done, but I have heard people say, oh, it's so much faster. I'm like, what do you mean it's so much faster? It's a little plane. It goes slower than the commercial jets. So then I did some digging. And by time, the time savings actually has nothing to do with the plane.
No.
It's all the before and after the flight.
Yes, absolutely. So getting to the airport. And
if you were to fly from Denver to LA, commercial versus private, flying private saves between 2 and 3 hours each way.
Easily.
So if you're making millions of dollars a year, your time is worth in the tens of thousands of dollars per hour. So spending 30 grand on a private jet or 20 grand or 17 or whatever it is, depending on the exact trip and the plane you need, actually makes a lot of sense from a purely financial perspective. Now there's the greenhouse gas pollution, climate change side of things, which is a whole nother discussion. And you know, I'm not advocating for y'all to be like Taylor Swift out here taking a plane to avoid a 5-minute car ride. Like, she literally holds the Guinness Book World Record for shortest private jet flight in like world history. It's a little over the top. But the point is, now I understand it's not just about, oh, it's luxury and I fly private and I'm all this. I mean, some people probably are that way. But if you're thinking about it from a time savings perspective, avoiding all the like check-in and the luggage and the security lines and all that, and you just get to hop on the plane and then get off and go. I mean, that time saving is really valuable. And then the other factor too is those smaller planes can land at way more airports.
True.
So you can, in many cases, land much closer to your destination. Like, for example, if you're flying here to go ski, most likely you're going to land in Denver and then you got to drive 2 hours.
True that.
Or you fly a smaller plane and then you can land somewhere up in the mountains that's 15 or 20 minutes away from the ski resort. And now you've not only saved the time on the check-in and check-out, but also on the drive time too. So that's how valuable time can be is the point. And it's like, it's something that over the last few years, like, my eyes have been really open to, and especially as my own like earning has gone up and I felt that squeeze of my time, I'm like, oh, I really do actually see the value in outsourcing some of these things, because like my time is so limited.
Agreed.
So those are 6 more lessons that we have learned in business and entrepreneurship and in life to help us. And we hope that you have gained some value out of this. And if you have, I would like to challenge you, dear listener, to find someone in your contact list and text them the link to this video or this podcast recording, however you decide to consume the podcast. Share it with one person. Let them know that you got some value out of it and you enjoyed it. It's the only way this podcast really grows. And we are so grateful that you listened to us today. We'll see you in the next one.